In other news.
To determine why and how the towers collapsed.
Kind of scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. In past shows, we've looked at bioenergetic instruments such as Don Croft's Zapper and Dr. Thomas Vallone's EM Pulsar. The electromagnetic pulsar, for example, is designed to lend electrons to the cells of a local area on the body, making it easier for a cell to repair itself instead of dying. This treatment conserves the additional energy needed to process the death of a cell and speeds up healing. We also talked in depth about the work of Dr. Royal Rife. Rife determined the frequencies of viruses and pathogens and invented a device that would kill them using their own frequency. The famous 1931 dinner celebration titled The End to All Disease honored Rife's pioneering work. Yet, by the year 1910, a blueprint for what is happening today within the medical establishment was already drafted and set in place. It was called the Flexner Report. Educational theorist Abraham Flexner, through the support of John D. Rockefeller of Standard Oil and Andrew Carnegie, visited 155 medical schools in the United States and Canada. Flexner's report recommended closing 120 medical schools based on their lack of standards and inability to adhere to the protocols of mainstream science. The Flexner Report emphasized laboratory research and the patenting of medicine. Today, the pharmaceutical industry, a select group of government agencies and corporations, continue operating under the Flexner Report, but also contextually as the byproduct of oil refinement. Despite this long-standing obstacle, different paradigms designed to treat underlying problems of chronic disease have gained traction in the United States. Our guest, Dr. Jerry Tennant, is a pioneer in treating patients by understanding the role that voltage has in a healthy functioning body. Dr. Tennant says all chronic disease is characterized by having inadequate voltage. He says we have four battery packs in our bodies, and we're wired like a circuit board, and the various circuits are wired through specific teeth. The teeth act as circuit breakers. However, emotional states create magnetic fields in the body that can block the flow of voltage, resulting in chronic illness. We explore Dr. Tennant's findings in the next hour. He's an ophthalmologist who did the majority of research for the Visix laser used in LASIK surgery. He is also a fellow in the American Society of Ophthalmic Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery. Dr. Tennant was director of the Ophthalmic Plastic Surgery Clinic at Parkland Hospital and founded the Dallas Eye Institute. Dr. Tennant is also licensed by the Arizona Board of Homeopathic and Integrated Medicine Examiners. He's the author of many books, including Healing is Voltage, The Handbook. Dr. Tennant, welcome to Another News.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Tennant, you had a life-changing event occur while performing laser surgery on a patient's eye. Can you tell listeners about that and how your research led to where you are now?
Sure. I did the majority. Well, first of all, before I begin, I always begin my interviews with the acknowledgement that I'm not speaking with my Texas MD license. I'm speaking with my Arizona MDH license. The reason for that is that the medical board in the state of Texas does not allow Texas physicians to speak about things that are not standard of care. And, of course, standard of care is defined basically by using drug, surgery, and physical therapy, and anything else is off limits. So when I do interviews or give lectures, I have to do it under my Arizona license. So with that caveat, I'm trained as an ophthalmologist, and I did the majority of research for the laser that's used in LASIK surgery. And I had a lot of fun doing that, but one of the things we didn't know at the time was that the laser wouldn't kill viruses. And there was a gentleman came to me, I think from Italy, but nevertheless, he had scarring on the front of his cornea. So I used the laser to carve those scars away, not knowing at the time that the laser wouldn't kill viruses. And as I removed his scars, it also released the viruses which went through my mask and into my nose and into my brain, and I developed encephalitis and also a bleeding disorder. And that caused me to have several disabilities. One of them was just overwhelming fatigue. And the other was that I could see a patient and figure out what was wrong with him, but I couldn't remember how to write a prescription. In addition, I developed spastic movements, which doesn't work really well if you're operating inside somebody's eyeball. And for all of those reasons, I had to quit work at the end of November in 1995. And so I had 2 or 3 hours a day in which I could understand a newspaper, and then like a light switch, it'd go off and I couldn't understand it anymore. And so I went to the best doctors I could find, and they all said, well, you have these viruses in your brain. We don't know what to do about it, so good luck. And so it became apparent to me that if I was going to get well, I was going to have to figure out how to do it in those 2 or 3 hours a day I could think. And that began to lead me down this path of understanding a different way of looking at how the body really works. So that's how it all began.
I can imagine that would be a motivator. And what were other doctors diagnosing your situation as?
Well, they said my electroencephalogram, or the brain wave test they did, was diagnostic of encephalitis. And then I had this bleeding disorder where my spleen was killing my platelets. And so the platelets are the little tiny sponges that float around in your body that stop up a wound when you have it, so you don't bleed a lot. And mine, a normal is 150 to 350,000, and mine dropped down to 30. And at that stage, you start bleeding under your skin, and you're at risk of bleeding into your brain. And so I had that problem as well. And as I mentioned, you know, the chronic, they called it the chronic fatigue syndrome, for lack of better terminology. So basically, I had those issues, and the doctor said, well, gee, we don't know what to do about it, so good luck.
They knew that you had viruses in your brain, and why is it important to know that this laser that you were using didn't kill viruses?
Well, what happened, you know, those of us who were doing the original research, I did about 90% of the research in this country for the company called Visix, and then there was a doctor in Vancouver and another one in Toronto that did a great deal of work for them as well. And the doc in Toronto got the basically same syndrome that I had, a low platelet count and fatigue. And the doctor in Vancouver got, when he would do surgery with the laser, then he'd end up spending the next few days in bed just, again, with overwhelming fatigue. So it became obvious that something was going on for those of us doing the research that involved the use of the laser. And, of course, eventually what happened was that the companies developed systems of taking the exhaust off of the patient's cornea and exhausting it away so it didn't go into the surgeon's noses. And all of the lasers now have that system, but that was a result of those of us who were doing it early getting sick.
It's unfortunate, of course, but fortunate in the results of what you've been able to create for treatment right now for your patients. But I want to ask you about how the work of Dr. Royal Rife and your research into healing with voltage integrate with each other.
Well, only remotely. Royal Rife was a person who, back in the beginning, if I recall, in the 30s, went to medical school, and after finishing his sophomore year, decided he liked bacteriology better than being a doctor. And so he became a bacteriologist, went to Germany and worked with the Zeiss organization and learned about microscopes, and then came back to California and began to try to understand infectious disease. And one of the things that Rife did was he would put a microorganism in a petri dish under his microscope, and then he used a frequency generator that activated what was basically an X-ray tube that was filled with helium, and he would change the frequency 1 hertz at a time until he saw the bacteria blow up that he was observing. And after he did that over 100 times and got the same frequency, then he would record that as what he called the mortal oscillatory rate of that particular microorganism. So it was Rife's belief that almost all illness was due to infections, and that if you would kill the infections then using electromagnetic energy, that people would get well. And indeed, he did see some improvements. So there are similarities between my work and Rife's in the sense that we're using electromagnetic energy, but that's kind of where it stops, because the reality is, as I've discovered, that you can't just kill infections and get people to stay well. They'll get better, but they don't stay well because that's not the root cause. The reality is to understand what really happens is that you have to understand a couple of things. One is that cells are designed to run at 25 millivolts of energy. And when those cells wear out, you need 50 millivolts to make new ones. And so characteristic of all chronic disease is the loss of adequate voltage. Now, people get confused because if you take a cell in a petri dish and stick an electrode inside the cell and one outside the cell and measure across the cell membrane, you get about 80 or 90 millivolts. But most of us don't have our cells in a petri dish. So the reality is that we have to have that our cells run in an environment of 25 to 50 millivolts of electron donor. And the next piece of the puzzle is that the amount of oxygen that will dissolve in a liquid is dictated by the voltage of the liquid, among other things, but voltage is one of the characteristics. So if you take a glass of water and start bubbling oxygen into it, if you raise the voltage, more oxygen will go into solution. If you lower the voltage, then oxygen comes out of solution and goes away. So as I've discussed, every organ in the body has to have voltage to work, and if the power supply to that organ or to those cells drops, then oxygen drops. Well, each of us contains maybe a trillion bugs of different types, but most all of those are what are called anaerobic, which means they can only thrive when the oxygen levels are low. So what happens is voltage drops, then oxygen drops, and when oxygen drops, the bugs wake up. And when the bugs wake up, they want to have lunch, and obviously they want to have you for lunch. And so then they start putting out digestive enzymes to dissolve our cells so they can get the nutrients they need, and that's how infectious disease is involved with making people sick. So if you take the Rife machine or a magic wand and you kill those bugs, guess what will happen? They'll come right back because you didn't fix the root cause, and the root cause was the loss of voltage, which caused you to lose the oxygen, which allowed the bugs to wake up and have their way with you. So again, if you use Rife machines to kill microorganisms, that will make people better shortly, but it doesn't solve the problem any more than people who have chronic illnesses and you give them antibiotics, they may feel better for a little while, but then they get sick again. Did I explain that well enough?
I think we wrapped up the interview, actually, Dr. Tennant. That's it.
There you go.
You've really summarized it very quickly, and I think we obviously we need to get more in depth here. And I appreciate you doing that, because if we don't have the right amount of voltage and oxygen levels in our cell structure, then we're going to be overrun by fungus and parasites and pathogens. Does that alarm you?
Well, I don't know if alarm's the right word. It helps. It educates me. It helps me understand when I see somebody who's ill, what's going on with them. So if you come to me and say, you know, my X doesn't work, then the first thing that I almost automatically know is that you don't have enough voltage going to that organ. So whether you're talking about your heart or your stomach or your kidney or whatever. And so then, of course, I go and measure just to be sure that I'm correct. But then once I know that the voltage is low in that circuit, I automatically know that the oxygen is low, and I automatically know that as oxygen continues to drop, you're going to get some sort of infection going on. as oxygen drops more, those infectious organisms are going to shed their cell membranes and become what are known as cell wall deficient organisms, or Leida Madman called them stealth pathogens, which are more pathological, but you can't see them and can't culture them. And then as voltage eventually drops more and more, it's going to flip the polarity, which goes from electron donor to electron stealer. So you go from minus 25 millivolts of electron donor to plus 30 millivolts of electron stealer, and it's a plus 30 millivolts where you get a malignancy. So voltage going from minus 25 millivolts all the way to plus 30 dictates how sick you are and eventually whether or not you're going to get a malignancy.
Many of us have a basic understanding of what a pH scale measures, and you summarized that really quickly, but you've gone in depth in your presentations about the human cell generation and pH level. Would you go into a little more detail about that specifically for listeners?
Sure. Well, if you think about the copper wire that's bringing voltage to my telephone, to my lights, to my computer and so forth in this room, electrons are flowing through a wire, and that's called conductive electricity. And you have an on-off switch. The switch is on, and the electrons move through. The switch is off, they stop. But if you have a solution, a liquid, it's a different situation, because liquids have the ability to be either electron donor or electron stealer. And so if you take what's called a pH meter, the pH meter is actually a sophisticated voltmeter, if you please, that will measure the millivolts in a liquid. And it also detects whether it's electron donor or electron stealer. So every pH meter has a switch on it. If you switch it into one mode, it will give you the readout in millivolts. And if you switch it to the other position, it'll translate that millivolt reading into a logarithmic scale called pH. Now, by convention, if the liquid is an electron donor, you put a minus sign in front of the voltage. And if it's electron stealer, you put a plus sign in front of the voltage. So plus 400 millivolts of electron stealer is the same as a pH of zero, and minus 25 millivolts electron donor is the same thing as pH of 14. So plus 400 to a minus 400 of voltage gives you a pH range of 0 to 14. So the issue then is that in a liquid, you have the opportunity to be electron donor, electron stealer, and one can define which it is and how much it is, either in terms of millivolts and or translate it to a logarithmic scale called pH. Now, obviously, if I say to you that cells are designed to run at a pH of 7.35 to 7.45, really probably doesn't resonate that much with you. But if I say cells are designed to run between minus 20 and minus 25 millivolts, now it's easier to get your mind around that, particularly as you see changes. And so that's what every cellular biology book will tell you, that cells must run at a pH of 7.35, which is equivalent to saying minus 20 millivolts, or 7.45, which is the equivalent of minus 25 millivolts. And then the important thing to remember is that to make a new cell, you need double that. You need minus 50 millivolts to make a new cell. And here's the important thing that people forget. Every cell in the body is constantly wearing itself out and having to be replaced. And so, as I've just told you, to make a new cell, you need minus 50 millivolts. So all chronic disease is defined by having inadequate voltage to make new cells. So when you understand what I just said, it changes the way you think about illness. So again, all chronic disease is defined by having inadequate voltage to make new cells and to make them run properly. That kind of leads us into the discussion of, okay, well, so what's the body's electronic and battery system? Because indeed, since the human body is a portable electronic device, like all portable electronic devices, it has to have a battery system. So it turns out that the body actually has five different battery sets to make things work. The largest one happens to be our muscles. Now, our muscles are what's called piezoelectric. So what's that funny word mean? Well, if you take a piece of quartz and you squeeze it with a pair of pliers, it emits electrons. So the process of distorting something and causing it to emit electrons is called piezoelectricity. So every time you move yourself, you move your muscles, they are generating electrons. And fortunately, also, our muscles are rechargeable batteries. And so our muscles are stacked one on top of each other in a very specific order, like stacking batteries in a flashlight for a power pack. And they're surrounded by a common sheath of what's called fascia. Fascia is that white, shiny stuff you see when you carve your Thanksgiving turkey. And fascia, then, is a stocking that surrounds a specific stack of muscle batteries to form a battery pack. So every organ in the body has its own battery pack, and a stack of muscle batteries, what's been called an acupuncture meridian. So that our major power supply, then, is our muscles, and exercising is the mechanism by which we normally keep them charged. Now, fascia is actually a semiconductor. So what in the world is a semiconductor? Well, a semiconductor is a collection of molecules arranged in such a way that electrons can move through them at the speed of light, but only in one direction. So the body's wiring system, if you please, is the fascia. And it'll move electrons through from the battery pack to wherever they need to go through the fascia at the speed of light. Well, the next thing is that our cell membranes are actually capacitors. And so what's a capacitor? Well, a capacitor is a small battery. Because of the way the phospholipids are designed in our cell membranes, they can actually store electrons in the cell membrane itself. And then just under the cell membrane, we have a collection of water that's not H2O, but it's H3O2. And that particular format of water is an electron donor form of water. So the water under our cell membranes actually is a third battery. And then inside our cells, we have these little things called mitochondria. And inside the mitochondria, we have another rechargeable battery system called ADP-ATP. When the battery is discharged, it's called ADP. When it's charged up, it's called ATP. Well, if you have a rechargeable battery inside your cell, you need a battery charger. And that battery charger is called the Krebs cycle or the citric acid cycle. And so for every unit of fat you put into that battery charger, if oxygen is present, you get enough electrons to charge up 38 of those little ATP batteries. But if oxygen is unavailable, for every unit of fat you put into the Krebs cycle, you only get enough electrons to charge up two batteries. So obviously oxygen is critical in the ability to charge up those batteries. And then finally, we have DNA, and our DNA is in a spiral, like it took a ladder and twisted it, but that creates a hole down the center of it. It's another discussion of why, but energy that is between the Earth and the ionosphere is called scalar, and scalar will implode into the center of the DNA to energize it. And so life can only exist if we have exposure to the scalar energy to keep our DNA charged up. So there are five batteries that I've just described that provide all of the energy for the body to work and to repair itself when it gets worn out or damaged.
Thank you for going into depth and explaining that for our listeners. The muscles are rechargeable battery packs, and the fascia tissue around the muscles serve as the body's wiring system. This is a new paradigm, I would say. Were you instrumental in discovering this, Dr. Tennant?
Well, yes and no. You know, people like me stand on the shoulders of many others, and what you find is you'll be studying, trying to figure out how things work, and you run across an article that proves that muscles are piezoelectric. Well, that in and of itself doesn't define our battery system, does it? Then you go find another article that says that fascia is a semiconductor. Well, in and of itself, that doesn't tell you how the body works. So what I've been able to do is to take a variety of these different pieces of information and assemble them into what appears to be a more logical explanation of how things really work. So as far as I know, I'm one of the first to put it together into the system I've described, but again, there are others who have come before me that allowed that to happen. I have to give credit to where it's due to the people who came before me.
I can imagine at this point in your life when you only had a certain window of opportunity to mentally grasp this information that you were researching every day. I think you said you had a window of 2 to 3 hours a day.
Yep.
And this must have taken years to assemble. And at this point in gathering information and synthesizing this information, what were you able to do to begin helping your health issues?
Well, as I began to understand what was going on, I ran across the work of a fellow named Nakatani. Nakatani was a Japanese acupuncturist who was the first person to use modern electronics to measure acupuncture meridians. And he published in 1951. The following year, 1952, Reinhold Voll in Germany published very similar work. So I got Nakatani's fairly rudimentary equipment and began to measure myself and found that where my brain should be running at 25 millivolts, it was running between 2 and 4 millivolts, so now I knew why it didn't work. Then the next issue was, what are you going to do about it? And I began to move forward trying to figure out how, first of all, why my batteries were low, and secondly, what to do to correct it. And the biggest issue that I discovered is that all of these various acupuncture circuits in the body go through very specific teeth. And so if you think about an individual tooth and you've got, it's part of a, let's say you've got a copper wire hooked up to something that's a cylinder. If you distort that cylinder in some way, then that distortion becomes like a resistor to the flow of electrons through it. And so imagine then that a simple decay in a tooth begins to act like a resistor and it's going to start dropping the voltage in that circuit. And then as the decay gets worse and worse, then it's a bigger resistor. And finally, what we discovered is that when the infection moves from the tooth into the bone around the tooth, it actually acts like a circuit breaker and simply flips that circuit off. So the major drops then where you go from lower amounts of electron donor to actually over into the electron stealer category and eventually down to plus 30 millivolts where malignancies occur is due to infection. One of the primary things that causes that to happen is the infection in a bone around a tooth. So one of the major issues about chronic disease is that the people often have a hard time getting their mind around the fact that a tooth can make some other organ fail, but indeed that's what happens. And if you understand the circuitry, you can begin to understand how that works. Now, the issue then is brings us to root canal teeth. A root canal tooth is a dead tooth. So what the dentists do is they drill a hole in the tooth, put an auger down in it, and rip out the artery and rip out the nerve and kill the tooth. So the dentists are the only physicians that think you can get away with leaving dead tissue in the body. No other doctor believes that. What you find is that work by Boyd Haley at the University of Kentucky has shown that one root canal tooth shuts down 63% of your immune system. But and that's due to the toxins that it puts out because all dead tissue gets infected and puts out very severe toxins. But in addition to the toxins, you have this interference with the flow of electrons in the acupuncture battery pack to whatever organ. So the work we did here in our clinic and probably half a dozen clinics in Europe have published the same thing, and that is that somewhere between 90 and 95% of all malignancies are associated with a root canal tooth or infection in a bone where the tooth was pulled to any malignancy that's in that circuit. So, for example, somebody comes in with a breast cancer, you're 95% sure that there's either a root canal or a tooth that's been pulled in an upper molar or lower premolar on the same side of the body as that tumor. That, I think, is a huge step forward in helping us understand how malignancies occur. Now, people say to me, well, I've had a root canal for 10 years and I don't have a malignancy. Well, that's true, but let's use Dr. Boyd's 63% analogy. Let's assume you make $1,000 a month, but there's a $630 tax, so you're left with $370 to live on. Well, you're getting by, but then your car needs new tires, your kid falls and breaks an arm, so now you've got a doctor's bill. Pesticide people come by and spray your house with that, and all of a sudden, those additional electron stealers have consumed that $370. Then all of a sudden, you're overdrawn in that account, so to speak, and now you flip the polarity from electron donor to electron stealer, and then as time goes on, it gets lower and lower until finally you're at plus 30 millivolts. Now, the point that I'm making is that essentially all chronic disease, you will find there is an association with a dental infection in that circuit.
This is extremely profound to begin to understand, because what we've seen with conventional medicine is the treatment of the symptoms themselves. For example, chemotherapy for a brain tumor. A friend's wife was diagnosed with a brain tumor, and it was strongly suggested by her doctor to undergo chemotherapy. And I was wondering, is there an alternate treatment suggested by the Tenet Institute?
Well, not by the clinic. We don't claim to treat cancer in our clinic. But what happened was that in 2013, Thomas Seyfried in Boston published that cancer is not caused by mutated genes, which is profound. Because in the 50-plus years I've been in medicine, that's been the theory, that for some unknown reason, genes mutate. The mutated genes cause tumor cells to form, for the cells to form rapidly and make a tumor. And that dictated the treatment, and that is you can go in and cut out the tumor and throw it away, assuming you're throwing away the mutated genes. Or you can use chemotherapy to try to kill rapidly growing cells, or you can use radiation, which kills anything it touches. But what Seyfried did was he took a cancerous cell, removed its nucleus, and put in a normal nucleus, assuming that the cell would become normal. It did not. It stayed malignant. He then did the opposite, where he took a normal cell, removed its normal nucleus, and put in a cancer nucleus, assuming the cell would become malignant. It did not. It stayed normal. And when this was repeated at several other universities, it proved that mutated genes aren't what's driving the bus in cancer, that they're simply secondary phenomena. And so that changes everything. Also, the Australians showed that chemotherapy extends five-year survival rate by approximately 2.3%, which obviously means that it's not a terribly effective therapy. So that will raise questions in some people's minds, because they're going to say, well, I read that chemotherapy cures 70% of this cancer or 80% of that one. Well, to understand how they come up with those numbers, you actually have to understand the difference between relative risk and absolute risk. So, for example, during the first half of my career, all the medical studies were reported in what's called Kaplan-Meier. And what that means is that you take two groups. Let's say you're looking at a drug to try to prevent heart attacks. So you give one group the drug, the other group you get sugar pills, and at any point in the future, you can compare the two groups, can't you? Well, that's called Kaplan-Meier, but they quit doing that about, I don't know, maybe 25 years ago, and started reporting in what's called relative risk. So here's what that means. let's say you have 6 people out of 100 that have athlete's foot. That's a 6%. Now let's say you do something and now only 3 people out of 100 have athlete's foot. Well, the absolute reduction is from 6% to 3%, which is an absolute reduction of 3%. But it will be reported as a 50% reduction because 3 is 50% of 6. So obviously there's a huge difference between a 50% reduction and a 3% reduction, but that's the way all of our medical studies are reported now. Now extend that on out. Let's say there's 6 out of 10,000 and you reduce it to 3 out of 10,000. The difference is almost nothing, but it'll still be reported as a 50% improvement. And so that's the way our medical studies deceive physicians and thus the patients as to the effectiveness of various therapies, and that's why we see such profound differences in what are claimed to be effects of things like chemotherapy or other systems. Well, the issue then is that once Seyfried proved that cancer is not caused directly by mutated genes, one needs to find a different theory, and I've proposed a different theory, and again, it's just a theory for others who are involved with academia to prove or disprove this theory if they wish. But if we're going to come up with a different theory, let's look at the things that we think we know. First of all, there have been many studies published in the last 5 years that show that normal cells don't become malignant, only stem cells do. And so the first person to recognize that was an embryologist in Edinburgh, Scotland in 1903, who noted that the cells that make a placenta in a pregnant woman are indistinguishable from cancer cells. They look like cancer cells. They act like cancer cells. They go out and invade the wall of mother's uterus and invade the blood vessels and create a mass of blood vessels to support the growing fetus, which we call a placenta. And he also noted that on day 54 of the pregnancy, that those cells quit being malignant. They quit invading things. And so he wondered what the switch was that caused that to happen and discovered that on that particular day that the fetal pancreas began to work. So he went out and squeezed juice out of pancreas, injected it into animals with cancer, and cured them. He did the same thing with humans and cured them. And so in 1911, he wrote a book called The Enzyme Treatment of Cancer. But he was totally ignored until the mid-60s, when Frank Shively, a surgeon in Dearborn, cured 192 cases of cancer using pancreatic enzymes, which caused the FDA to outlaw their use in this country. Approximately that same time, the mid-60s, there was a dentist here in the Dallas area in Grapevine, Texas, who himself got pancreatic cancer. His name was William Kelly, and Dr. Kelly cured himself by taking oral pancreatic enzymes. So soon the physicians in North Texas started sending this dentist their cancer cases, and he treated over 10,000 people. But he was otherwise ignored until a medical student at Cornell by the name of Nicholas Gonzalez had to write a thesis and chose to prove that Dr. Kelly was a quack. And so he came to Kelly's office and Kelly said, yeah, they're my records, help yourself. And pretty soon it became obvious to Dr. Gonzalez that he was indeed curing cancer. And so he picked 50 people out of the 10,000 plus and went and interviewed them some 15 years after they should have died and wrote his thesis, but nobody would publish it. Gonzalez went on to practice Dr. Kelly's protocols until he was found mysteriously dead in his bed last year in New York. Well, then, so we have to sort of explain, well, how is it that all of this happened over all of these years since 1903? Well, I think a piece of the puzzle is the work of Yamamoto. Yamamoto discovered that surrounding every placenta, every solid tumor, and most viruses is a protein called Nagalase, which shuts down the local immune system. Well, being a protein, one could dissolve it with proteolytic enzymes, which are present in pancreatic enzymes, and so one could predict these pancreatic enzymes would dissolve the amylase and thus allow the immune system to attack the tumor. The other piece of the puzzle has to do with the work that was done by Otto Warburg back in the 30s in Germany, where he showed that cancer could not exist if the levels of oxygen are normal. Well, obviously, the levels of oxygen are dictated, as we've already discussed, by the voltage, isn't it? So basically what Warburg told us is that if the voltage is normal, then you can't have a malignancy. Well, that was emphasized by the work of a physicist who looked at cell membranes by the name of Keith Brewer. Brewer published, I think it was in the 70s, normal cells run at a pH of 7.45, which is minus 25 millivolts, but the tumors are always at a pH of 6.5, which is plus 30 millivolts. So what Brewer told us is that cancer occurs when you go from electron donor to electron stealer, that is to say from minus, which is electron donor, to plus, which is electron stealer. And thus, what he said is that it's flipped the polarity. Well, it's well known in battery technology that if you take a rechargeable battery and you drain it all the way to zero, it flips its polarity upside down. So understanding that every organ has its own battery pack, but if that battery pack drains to the point that it discharges itself, it will flip its polarity upside down, which means that oxygen disappears. So the theory that I've presented is that the switch that tells stem cells to go out to the neighborhood and invade the local blood supply and make a mass of blood vessels is basically flipping of polarity. And thus, that tells the stem cells, hey, guys, we're dying over here. We don't have oxygen. Please help. And so it goes into the neighborhood, brings in the blood vessels, and thus more oxygen to try to keep the thing alive. So the theory, and again, this is just a theory that I've proposed, is that all solid tumors are actually placentas. Well, once you, if you buy into that concept, then you realize that if you simply go in and take out a tumor and don't fix the oxygen problem by fixing the voltage problem, the body's just going to make another one because you haven't fixed the root cause. And so that's the theory, and again, I emphasize it's a theory that I propose for those who are in academia and have the resources to do so, that they may wish to explore this theory to see if it's correct or not. But to my way of thinking, it explains what we do see with malignancies, and that is, if you measure it, the acupuncture circuit going to the tumor is always has reverse polarity.
That's fascinating. The stem cells are recognizing a low voltage, and they're going in to make more blood vessels and then creating more oxygen, I think, to the surrounding tissue. But that is creating a cancer.
Yeah, we call it cancer because cancer sort of has this connotation of, oh, this is an enemy that's here to try to hurt me. I've got to cut it out and throw it away and stomp on it and destroy it in whatever mechanism I can. But when you realize that the body has limited resources and limited things that it can do to try to overcome severe lack of oxygen. And in the case of a pregnancy, that's exactly the situation you have. And if you begin to think in terms of every organ in the body has its own battery pack, and that if that battery pack loses its charge, that causes a lack of oxygen to be available to that organ. And the lack of oxygen then is perhaps the switch that tells stem cells, hey, we're running out of oxygen over here, please help. And so the stem cells go out and create a new lifeline, if you please, to try to keep that organ alive. It certainly changes the way we look at cancer, doesn't it? So it's not just some evil thing that happens to you or some random thing that causes mutation of cell, of genes that causes it. You simply have to add up the electron stealers. And what you'll find in almost every illness, including cancer, is that there's a combination. So usually it's some combination of the following. First of all, thyroid hormone controls the voltage of every cell membrane in the body. T3 controls the cell membranes and the total number of mitochondria. T2 actually controls the mitochondria themselves. So you have to be sure you have enough thyroid hormone or nothing else really works right. Secondly, if you put a scar across one of these battery packs and it touches the fascia, it simply drains off some of the voltage. So scars often will block the flow of voltage through one of your battery packs and drain off some of it. So you have to test and fix the scars, and we know how to do that, which is beyond the scope of this few minutes we've got left. So you look at thyroid, you look at scars, and then you look at dental infections. As I've already discussed, a dental infection acts first like a resistor in the circuit and then later acts like a circuit breaker and switches the circuit off. And then finally, you look at emotions. Turns out that all information is stored in the body very much like a magnetic field. Like if you're making a DVD, you have a magnetic needle that goes around and writes on the disc. Well, that a similar process is going on when you have sensory input. And if the sensory input is distorted, that is to say it's an emotion, then it stores it at a frequency that's somewhat different than normal, and so the body recognizes that as an abnormality and actually consumes a lot of energy to do that. And then finally, we have toxins. Toxins are electron stealers, and we do live in a toxic environment. And so if you find a circuit that's discharged, you go through the checklist. Do you have enough thyroid? Do you have scars? Do you have dental infections? Do you have emotions? Do you have toxins? And usually it's some combination of those that ends up creating a chronic disease, which if it continues, the voltage drops more and more, and eventually you end up with a malignancy in that circuit. So there isn't one cause for chronic disease, and there isn't one cause for cancer. That's why it's been elusive, in my view, and that is that it's a combination of electron stealers that drop the voltage, which drops the oxygen, which allows the bugs to show up and have their way with you. And eventually you end up with a tumor, and then if you don't correct the voltage and the oxygen, then the body succumbs to that. Simple as that.
What you've done here, the way you've assembled very critical pieces of the puzzle to expose a number of underlying causes to chronic illness is paramount and extremely important, and I'm so glad you did this work. The idea that a magnetic field caused by an emotional state will affect the flow, the normal flow of voltage in various systems is another very important element. I wanted to ask you in the minutes that we have remaining about the increased wireless radiation in our environment from sources such as cell towers, smart meters, and wireless routers, cell phones, and what your thoughts are on the effects caused to the body's battery voltage system. Does EMF, cell phone radiation, interfere with the thyroid gland and that hormone that controls voltage, or does it have other effects within your research?
Well, I've not done any original research in that area, but I do see patients that come in, for example, that are very sick and they got sick right after they put a smart meter on their house, for example. So the thing you have to understand about electromagnetic radiations is whether they are electron donors or electron stealers, and whether they are in harmony with the frequencies of the organ systems or disharmony. So every organ in the body runs at a different frequency. But, you know, let's say you go to Las Vegas and you go where they have all the machines, all of a sudden your cell phone doesn't work. Why is that? Because they're blasting an electromagnetic signal across there that blocks the frequencies on which cell phones work. Well, again, each organ in your body has a specific frequency, and if you happen to be bombarded with frequencies that block those signals, it's going to make that organ not work correctly, you see. On the other hand, if you put in frequencies that match or resonate with the frequencies that the organs normally use, that makes that organ work better. So, but, you know, if you look at the package insert that comes with your cell phone, you will see in very fine print, usually toward the last of the book and down toward the bottom of the page, it says, don't hold a cell phone closer to your head than 5 inches or 7 inches or something like that. Well, of course, nobody reads that. Nobody pays any attention to it. But there have been studies done that show that these electromagnetic energies are damaging. They're the wrong frequency that actually are harmful and powerful enough. So, for example, I may take a flashlight, or I may be driving at night, and the light that comes out of the LEDs of somebody's taillights is not going to be harmful to me. But on the other hand, if you increase the wattage of those LEDs up to a certain point, then that same LED frequency is going to be harmful to me and could actually be used to be weaponized. So, and then, of course, there's all of this stuff going on with the various cell towers. There's a lot of commotion out there right now about the new 5G, et cetera. So I just would mention, you mentioned in one of your communications about some research done by a chap, and I looked up his work. And
Dr. Salford?
It bothered me in the... because I see this all the time, and that is he had 8 patients in his groups. And I don't know how they got published, because unless you have at least 40 people in a group, it is not statistically significant. And so one should never publish, in my view, work that has less than that, because the conclusions you come to may be totally erroneous. When you have such few numbers, it just shouldn't be done, in my view.
Okay, thanks for mentioning that. Just put in context, this is Dr. Salford, who studied the blood-brain barrier breach in rats from cell phone radiation exposures.
You know, if you have eight rats in this group and 8 rats in that group, and you take the data and you look at it, the conclusion you come to may be totally opposite of what you'd come to if you had 50 rats in each group. And so I think it's inappropriate, in my view, to publish or pay any attention to studies that don't have adequate numbers, because they can lead you down the primrose path.
Mm, okay. That's really good to know. So people listening, maybe somebody else can do a study. I hate to see this being done, but maybe they can do it on people, because there's certainly a number of people exposing themselves to cell phone radiation right now. That's for sure.
Yeah, you know, the problem is simply the funding. Who's going to put up the money to do it? And there's this enormous amount of money that says don't publish this information. So, I mean, if you, for example, there was a study that was published a few years ago where someone used Freedom of Information Act to get information from the FDA that was filed for the approval of a certain drug. What they found was that the studies that showed that the drug worked, most all of those got published. The studies that showed the drug didn't work, almost none of those got published. And so this whole business of what we read in so-called scientific studies these days has been so contaminated to the point that the editor of both the New England Journal of Medicine and, two of the most respected journals in medicine, their editors published, you really can't believe anything you read in our journal anymore, because it's biased by funding.
It's really a shame, because the implication is they're hiding something that would reveal, maybe long-term harm to, the biology of human beings, especially with technology such as cell phones and smart meters, wireless routers, and things like that. And I would imagine you see plenty of electromagnetic hypersensitivity cases. Would you please tell listeners about the Tennant Institute?
Okay. Well, I have a medical facility in the Dallas, Texas area called Tennant Institute, where we see people primarily who have been chronically ill and can't find a solution to their problem. And so our website is simply that, tennantinstitute.com. My office phone, 972-580-1156.
Dr. Tennant, thank you so much for being on In Other News.
All right, be well.
As you've heard, Dr. Tennant explained how maintaining proper voltage in the body will keep it from chronic disease, but also the various pathogens, including Lyme disease. Dr. Tennant said that we all carry Lyme, but the oxygenated environment keeps it from, quote, waking up. The other component, Dr. Tennant points out, is that most chronic disease begins with an emotional event causing a magnetic field in a tooth. Emotions are stored in the body as magnetic fields. The majority of chronic illness begins with an emotional event. Emotions block the flow of electrons through a tooth, lowering the voltage in that circuit. Emotions block the dental pump, allowing for decay and dental infections to occur, further lowering the voltage in that circuit. Again, more information can be found at thetennantinstitute.us. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Join me again Monday, 11 p.m. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.